This is the continuation of the oral history interview with Emeritus Professor of Communication Arts, Tino Baglio, also Emeritus Director, First Director of the Arts Institute. Today is December 1st, 2005. Tino, we wanted to pick up the interview and have you discuss the balance of your research.
Yes. Previously, I talked about my history of United Artists Corporation from 1919 to 1951, when the company was owned by Charlie Chaplin and Mary Pickford and other prominent producers in Hollywood. I was offered an opportunity by United Artists Corporation to write volume two of that history, beginning in 1951, when a new management team took over United Artists and saved it from bankruptcy, to 1978, when that very same management team walked out of the company to form Orion Pictures. And the walkout was over a controversy and disagreement with the new parent company of United Artists, which was Transamerica Corporation, an insurance conglomerate located in San Francisco that acquired United Artists in the late 1960s. In any event, the friends that I had in UA's management contacted me in the 1980s when United Artists was being sold by Transamerica to MGM. And they offered me an opportunity to write volume two of United Artists, and gave me the opportunity to search out any material or materials that I wished in their warehouse. The new warehouse for United Artists Corporation was located in the Meadowlands in New Jersey, and it was in a corporate warehouse setting. The warehouse itself was about the size of an airplane hangar, and it was literally filled with transfile boxes with corporate records. And they said that I could Xerox anything I wished to write my history. And they even provided me with a Xerox machine in the warehouse, so that over a period of several months, or maybe even a year, I made several trips to this warehouse and Xerox materials that I thought that I might need. However, it was like searching for needles in a haystack, because the materials in storage were not really cataloged. They were shipped there by the different offices and different executives in the parent company in New York City, as these materials were no longer needed by them. So I had to really use a great deal of ingenuity to try to track down stuff that I could use for my book. And I'm sure I left behind tons of materials that were very valuable that I did not have access to because I didn't know they existed. But I think I was able to acquire enough documentation to write the history. Moreover, the former chairman and CEO of the company, Arthur Krim, promised me that he would give me extensive interviews, opportunities, and to share with me some of the materials that he had retained after he left his office at United Artists Corporation. Also, several executives at UA offered to cooperate with me to give me interviews about anything that I might wish to explore about the history of the company. So, with those promises, those assurances, and the opportunity to have access to primary source documentation, I started to work on the history of United Artists Part 2, or Volume 2, if you will. Unlike my previous history, this time I attempted to analyze how a major motion picture company operated. What kinds of decisions did the company make? How did they go about financing films? When they financed a film, how did they go about evaluating the market potential of a film? How did they distribute films? What kind of distribution strategies did the company use to distribute a film? How did the company promote such films? What was the importance of ancillary markets like television and sound recordings and things like this? So I wanted to create a, or to discover the operations of the company, and then to describe the United Artists as a case study of how a major motion picture company, a modern major motion picture company, operated in the post-World War II period. The book was published in 1987 by the University of Wisconsin Press. It was not as good of a book as I had hoped it was, although it has gotten plenty of good press since it was published, because I discovered that Arthur Krim was a very busy man, and he did give me extensive interviews. But I discovered that what he told me was approximately the same thing that he had told other people who had interviewed him previously for such publications as the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and so forth. So he didn't really give me anything new. He actually gave me information that I could have discovered somewhat on my own. And he also had told me that he had kept a record of all of his correspondence as CEO of the company. But after I agreed to write the book, he discovered that these materials did not truly exist. So I did not have access to his very private papers. Although he did have some private papers that he gave me access to on the proviso that I could read the material but not take notes on it. But I think I did as good of a job as I could have at the time. There's no perfect book. Management of the company collaborated with me, as I said, and one person in particular, Herbert Schottenfeld, who was a vice president in charge of legal services for the company, gave me some marvelous information about how United Artists acquired and developed the James Bond series. And I am forever indebted to him for that. In doing my research for the book, I interviewed a UW alum, Walter Mirisch, who with his brothers had formed the Mirisch Corporation, an independent production company that was allied with United Artists and supplied United Artists with dozens of excellent films during the 60s and 70s, including several Academy Award winners and big budget and very successful films. Walter Mirisch I interviewed several times. The first time I interviewed him, he was somewhat hesitant about revealing inside corporate information, but after I showed him some drafts of materials from the book that I wanted to include in the book, he became a little bit more open and gave me more information than he had earlier. So even though he didn't reveal everything that I might have wanted to know, his interviews were helpful. There's no question about it. Well, I should put all this in perspective as well, because we're now talking about the period of the 1980s, and very few business executives from Hollywood really reveal inside corporate information to anybody. And I was lucky to get from them what I did. Today, I suppose, information is more available. People tend to talk more, blog more and everything. But back in the 80s, it was difficult to get this kind of information. And I think that I was successful in writing the book primarily for film scholars and for film students to give them some idea as to how a major company operates, what kinds of decisions it makes, what its economic constraints are, and so forth. And I am proud of the book. There's no question about it. I must say, however, that the University of Wisconsin Press did not promote the book very well. One of the drawbacks of the University of Wisconsin Press, I must say, is that it doesn't have any marketing muscle. And it's not unusual for a university press to not have much marketing muscle, but I felt that this was a disappointment that they could not have marketed the book or promoted it any better than they did. However, on the plus side, they published very beautiful books. I was very pleased with the way the book looked, its typographical layout, and the cooperation I got from the staff in terms of the book's design. So that was the trade-off. After I published this book, and by the way, the title of the book was called United Artists, The Company That Changed the Film Industry. The title is somewhat similar to my previous UA book, but it does have a modifier which indicates a new phase of United Artists history.
Tino, when you wrote that book and you had completed it, were there any findings that truly amazed you? Did you learn anything that was stunning?
Well, yes, I did. No question about it. And of course, everything is in the details. People assume that the company's economic prosperity is dependent upon the profits that a motion picture makes. This seems to be quite obvious. If you are a motion picture company, and if your films are profitable, therefore you make money. Well, what I discovered in my investigation, that United Artists, as a distribution company, now United Artists, I should say, never produced motion pictures. What it did was to finance the production of motion pictures, films that would be produced by independent producers.
Like the Mirage Company.
Like the Mirage Corporation. UA would put up the financing. In return for the financing, United Artists acquired the distribution rights to the films. The actual films themselves belonged to the producer, but UA had acquired the distribution rights, for the most part, in perpetuity. They didn't care, you know, about who owned the film. What they wanted to do was to distribute the film. And when United Artists distributes the film, of course, it receives film rentals from exhibitors, and the film rentals go to pay off the loan that was used to finance the motion picture. The film rentals that came into the company also pay off the cost of the prints and advertising. And then after that, if there's still a flow of money from film rentals, the money goes to pay off the debt of the film, or in other words, its production cost. But before the money goes to the producer to pay off the production loan, UA deducts a distribution fee of approximately 30 to 35% of all the monies that come in from film rentals. Oh. UA gets first call on that. So by doing some simple arithmetic or math, one could discover that literally the company itself could be profitable from the distribution fees it charged, whereas the producer of the film may not make any money at all from the profits. Of course, the independent producers always receive production fees for making the film, but their share of the profits might be minimal, or they may not have any share of the profits because the film didn't break even. But because UA was able to deduct its distribution fee from the top as all this money came in, it could recoup its investment and sometimes make money even though the film itself was unprofitable. And this is just one of several mysteries about film distribution. You must understand that this ability of a company, of a film distribution company, that acquires perpetual distribution rights to a film, acquires the rights to the film in the theatrical market, the non-theatrical market, and all media, which means television, ancillary markets like home video, DVDs, and so forth. So that whenever they distribute a film, whenever they acquire rentals or proceeds from the sale of the film, they always deduct their distribution fee. And this is a reward for taking the risk and putting up the production financing. Okay. And that, in a nutshell, is a key to understanding Hollywood during the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Now, Hollywood in the 90s is different, that's a different story, but nonetheless, the key factor here is, or at least was, the distribution fee and the rewards that accrued to film distributors as a result of taking the financial risk of financing the film.
Mm-hmm. Tino, perhaps we can jump ahead a bit as we address your research. You're working on a new book now.
Yes. I am.
Can you talk about that a little?
Well, let me first of all give you a brief summary of the work that I did after my United Artists book.
Oh, okay.
And what I'm doing today, because my research is programmatic. I don't branch off into new areas. I tend to build on what I have already done.
Okay.
So I think I've been rather systematic about going about my research. The book that I did after my second United Artists book was a collection of original chapters on the interrelationship of Hollywood and television. And the book was called Hollywood in the Age of Television. And this was a book that was similar to an earlier collection of essays that I had published in the 70s called The American Film Industry. But this new one, this new collection of essays, I commissioned scholars in the field who were doing new research, cutting-edge research on a phenomenon that was occurring in Hollywood at this time. Up until network television, there was essentially only one market for feature films. That was the theatrical market. After a film played motion picture theaters, the film would go into a film vault, seldom if ever seen again unless it was reissued, and most films were not reissued. During the beginning of the 1960s, as with the advent of new technologies, there was created what is called ancillary markets. What do you do with the film? How do you distribute it after it has completed its theatrical run? And the advent of network television provided Hollywood with a very significant new ancillary market, so that after films were distributed theatrically, they would then be sold to network television for television broadcast. And then after network television, of course, the home video became prominent, and then other ancillary market, cable television as well. So my book, Hollywood in the Age of Television, attempted to analyze the interrelation, the symbiotic interrelationship between television and the film industries up until around 1980 or thereabouts, or the middle 80s. And this was a book that was very current at the time and documented, you might say, like a snapshot of Hollywood during the middle 80s. Of course, a lot has happened since then in terms of the importance of ancillary markets. Like for today, for example, with the advent of the DVD, the DVD market provides Hollywood with more revenue than the theatrical market for the most part. But you know, this is all evolving. But the point I wish to make is, though, that doing this Hollywood in the Age of Television book was, you might say, a spin-off of the research I had done for my UA history. In the early 1990s, I was approached by Charles Harpole, who was the editor, the general editor of a series called The History of American Cinema, which was being funded in part by the National Endowment for the Humanities. This was a collaborative project between the NEH and Charles Scribner's Sons. And the intent of this series was to write, you might say, quote, a definitive history of American film in 10 volumes from day one to 1990. I was invited to write the volume on Hollywood in the 30s and was given an NEH grant to do this. Charles Scribner's Sons was the publisher, and these books were designed to be distributed primarily to college libraries as reference books. Subsequently, the University of California Press acquired the paperback rights to the series, and the books were then sold, you know, to the general public as trade books. But I wrote a history of Hollywood during the 1930s. The name of the book is called Grand Design: Hollywood as a Major Motion Picture Enterprise. And there I attempted to describe the structure of Hollywood as a mature motion picture industry at the height of its power during the 1930s. And I attempted to describe how the structure of the industry influenced the kinds of films that Hollywood produced, and the quantity of films that Hollywood produced. In other words, I attempted to analyze Hollywood, which of course during this time was considered to be the most glamorous period of its film history, shrouded by many myths and so forth. But I attempted to describe how it functioned as a business, And it became a massive undertaking, and it received very excellent reviews. And in a sense, it was the capstone of all the work that I had been doing about Hollywood as a film industry. Oh. And in the year 2000, I applied to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences because they had inaugurated a senior scholars grant. They were beginning to offer on an annual basis $25,000 awards each year to senior scholars to write significant books in the history of film. And I applied, and I was the inaugural recipient of this award. And I received the $25,000 award to write a book on the history of foreign films in the United States during the 1950s and 60s.
Wonderful.
And this is the golden age, you might say, of foreign films in the United States. This is a period when films became, this is a period when, for the first time, foreign films really gained access to the American market. And this is a period when foreign films really changed people's perception of film as an art form. Prior to the 1950s and 60s, the general perception of film was just a mere form of entertainment. But with the advent of foreign films in the United States, and we're now talking about films from Italy, such as films produced and directed by Roberto Rossellini, Vittorio De Sica, films from France, films from Sweden, like the films of Ingmar Bergman, and many other European and international auteurs. I can name Akira Kurosawa, Federico Fellini, and many other international film auteurs. As a result of their films being distributed in the United States during the 50s and 60s, people's perception of film changed. Now film could be considered, and indeed was considered, to be a significant art form. So my job is to write a history of how foreign films influenced film culture in the United States during this important period. And I'm hoping to complete the book within the not too distant future. I've been working on it way too long. I've been working on it for at least 4 years. And even though I've enjoyed the research, I would like to bring it to a head pretty soon.
Will this be published by the UW Press?
No, it won't be. Two university presses have expressed interest in it. NYU Press and Columbia University Press.
Oh.
And I haven't decided yet how I want to publish it. I may want to go to a trade publisher, but I can't make this decision until at least write a draft to see if the book would have some interest to a wider public as opposed to the university public. I think that the book should be published by a New York press because the whole phenomenon of art films in the United States was basically a New York City phenomenon. Because mm-hmm. That's where all the films open in the United States, and that's where they got all their media coverage. And New York City had many, many art theaters during this time that provided venues for these films. It was the major market, you might say, for films, which bled over to other parts of the United States, but New York City was the port of entry, if you will, for foreign films. So logically, you might say, a New York publisher should be handling this book, but that's not absolutely necessary. But we'll see. After I write the first draft, I'll be able to figure this out.
And you're estimating that this will go to the publisher within the next year?
I'm not going to say this on tape.
Okay, Tino. Other copies of your book, are they available through your books through the UW Press?
The best way to access the books is through Amazon.com.
Oh, okay.
The quickest and easiest way to gain access to all of it, at least at this point.
Great.
Tino, I'd like to turn your attention now to your tenure as professor at the university in the late 60s and early 70s, when there was quite a bit of student unrest, both for the Vietnam War, the TA strike, and other issues confronting authority, and interested in your observations about that time.
Yes, this was a very interesting period of my life. I must say that when I came to the University of Wisconsin from Oberlin, I really wasn't politically committed. I think I had a liberal political bias, but I certainly would not characterize myself as being politically committed. I suppose I even had a streak of conservatism about me, even though I was in my late 20s by the time I got here. But I recall the first time I encountered student campus unrest, I tried to get into Bascom Hall. My office was located at the time in Van Hise Hall. I wanted to go to the speech department's office, and there were students ringing the building, preventing faculty from going into the building. I thought this was rather uppity on the part of the students. But this, of course, was just the beginning of a great deal of political unrest on campus. And of course, I had more direct experiences with this over the course of the following year. The most vivid experience I had when I was directing a play of Tennessee Williams called Camino Real. I was rehearsing the play in the Wisconsin Union Theater, and outside the theater, a student riot was taking place. This was not the first student riot by any means on campus, because prior to this time, the Dane County Sheriff and his deputies had tried to break up a student protest on campus, and indeed this was just another such event. And the incident was very vivid in my mind, or I should say, the protest at that time was very vivid in my mind, because as we were rehearsing the Wisconsin Union Theater, tear gas was seeping in from under the doors from outside. So I had to call the rehearsal to a temporary halt, but I went to the inner lobby of the Wisconsin Union Theater. And if you know the Wisconsin Union Theater, you know that there is an outer lobby which has a glass wall around, and then there's the inner lobby. So I was in the inner lobby and looking out into the outer lobby of the Wisconsin Union Theater, separated by a wall of glass. I saw a student run in from the outside, and I saw sheriff's deputies pursuing him from two directions, and they cornered him. And then they took out their bludgeons, I mean their nightsticks or whatever they had, and began to bludgeon this student, beating him very hard. And I heard the student groan. You must understand, this was like a silent film, because there was a glass wall separating us. I couldn't hear the groans or the shouts or the cursing that was going on, but I could just see these deputies beating the student. And then as he went down, he did let out a very loud groan, which I could hear through this glass wall. And that was a stunning, mesmerizing, demoralizing, if you will, event that I personally witnessed, of things like this were happening all along for over a period of time. And I can recall later that week when the protests and the fighting had reached a peak, and this was when the governor called in the National Guard. And we had an evening rehearsal at the Wisconsin Union Theater, and when I left one evening, the campus was pretty much deserted, but underneath the streetlights, these mercury vapor lights were on campus, I could see National Guardsmen posted as sentries. So this was an unusual period. I also thought, I must say, to be quite honest, that when these protests began, the university just turned over the campus to the local police authorities. Although the students taunted the deputies, the police, no question about it, they taunted them. But it seemed to me that the university administration, Ed Young in particular, in a sense abandoned their responsibilities to maintain control. I thought it was really bizarre for them just to let the police come in and confront the students without trying to ameliorate the whole situation.
Tino, this was 1968 or 69?
Yeah. Well, I don't remember the exact date. What I just described was my first reaction to the student protest when they first occurred.
Uh-huh.
The events that I described pertaining to when I was directing Camino Real were later, towards the very end. And then, of course, through this period, there was the bombing of Sterling Hall. And I remember this occurred in the summertime. I lived in Nakoma at the time. I was outdoors on my screen porch that evening when I heard this explosion. Didn't know what it was, and of course, we discovered what it was. And again, that was another vivid memory that will never go away. That was part of, you might say, growing up at the University of Wisconsin in a very turbulent period.
Were you astounded, Tino, to find yourself in a center of learning beset by the social forces? What did you think? Were you amazed? Were you...
Well, I wasn't that much older than many of these students. I was, in my late 20s. So I had, even though I was never a hippie, I coming from this.
This is side two, tape six, Emeritus Professor Tino Baglio, December 1st, 2005.
I think that the student revolts made me more conscious and aware of my own responsibility to be politically active, but rather than just, this was the first time you might say that young people or anybody in my generation or older really questioned authority. And of course, the war in Vietnam was a watershed event in modern American history because people began to distrust authority to a great extent because of the foolishness of the war, the number of American soldiers being killed, the fact that the carnage was being broadcast every night on network television. So it was not difficult to sympathize with the students. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, I ended up marching in some of the marches here in Madison. I must say, though, that at the time it was not difficult to be a liberal in Madison because the general consensus was that the community did sympathize to a certain extent with the students. I have to qualify that because things were changing so dramatically. It's really hard to generalize about either the students or the community during this period because things changed rather dramatically. I had mentioned a moment ago that I lived in Nakoma. Down the block from where I live, the mayor had a house. His name was Bill Dyke.
Oh.
This was about a block away from us. And I recall one day I was outside talking with our neighbors. Then we discovered, or it was discovered, I should say, that the students were going to march on the mayor's house. Bill Dyke was a rather conservative, reactionary mayor at the time who was not at all sympathetic to student political causes. But the news leaked out, or it was discovered that the students were going to march down Monroe Street to protest in front of the mayor's house. And it was rather interesting to observe my neighbors' responses to all this. One neighbor, who was a prominent surgeon in town, said, "I'm going to get a gun, and I'm going to sit in my living room, and if those students march on my lawn, I'm going to shoot them." Wow! And I said to myself, these are like your children you're talking about. These are kids, that either your children or your nephews and nieces. These are not Martians coming to protest in front of the mayor's house. But these were, quote, students, and they were to be feared and challenged and everything. And I thought, wow, this is really weird. That was another incident that I remember very vividly about this time. And I guess what I found was even more vivid, in a different way though, was how quickly everything subsided and how conservative everything became in the 1970s. It was as if we had forgotten their history. There was some relevance, academic relevance to all of this, peripheral maybe, but maybe not. As a result of the student protests, college administrations were forced to re-examine the so-called relevance of their curricula. And one of the side effects, if you will, of this examination and its response to student protests was the introduction of film studies to university curricula. Film was considered to be obviously an avant-garde subject. Many independent filmmakers and foreign filmmakers in their films, like The Battle of Algiers, Z, and many others, produced films that question authority, that question the existing political structure and so forth. In any event, film was a hot subject that students wanted to study formally in a college curricula, and this is all part of the general opening up of the traditional college curriculum to allow new things to be studied and analyzed. Like, for example, women's studies was an outgrowth of all this down the line, and other things. But up until this point, most curricula of significant universities were rather rigid, rather traditional, and so forth. But as a result of student unrest, the college curriculum, university curriculum, became more flexible, and it allowed for the introduction of new courses to be taught, new subject areas to be examined, and more important, I guess, a new way of looking at old texts, so forth.
And that clearly, from your perspective, was a good thing for in the academic center.
Right.
Tino, talk a little bit about the days of the TA strike and if that had impact on you or the department.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. It did not have a whole lot of impact on me per se, directly as a professor at the time, because I was not teaching a large lecture course that utilized TAs.
Okay.
But I do recall a meeting I had with Fred Haberman, who was chair of the speech department, and Bob DeRamis, who was the associate dean of letters and science at the time. And Bob DeRamis was in charge of the TA contract representing LMS. And it was funny because the TAs were pushing the envelope as far as what their demands were concerned. And one of the things that got Bob DeRamis really huffy was the fact that the TAs wanted chutney to be available in commons rooms so that when the TAs had their lunch, they would have access to this type of accoutrement. And this, of course, was funny, but it certainly got Bob Ramis's goat. They want chutney, he said. In addition to other things, obviously.
In addition to health insurance.
That's true, right? But the chutney part, nobody could quite get. I thought it was wonderful. the TA strike, this was bringing up lots of memories here. I mean, where did your allegiance lie? I mean, that as a professor, was your allegiance with the university or was your allegiance with the TAs? And you know, of course, your TAs were your graduate students, and up until this time, it was the typical university professor telling graduate students what to do, rather than vice versa. Also, this was a time, it was a very innocent time in many respects, because I had access, as any professor would, to one's personnel file, and I had went through it one time in recent years, and I saw the letter of recommendation that Fred Haberman wrote on my behalf to get a grant or some such thing. But, you know, he said such things, you know, that I was a well-dressed young man who had a pleasant family and so forth. And he didn't have to go into any great detail describing me beyond that because these were coded, this was coded language that gentlemen use to describe people,
yes.
I mean, people they were recommending. This meant that, you know, I was not a radical, I didn't have long hair, you know, that, you know, I was trustworthy, I had a family, a beautiful wife, a lovely house, you know, but I would not cause trouble. Well, anyway, that was a time that when everything changed. I mean, this was the beginning, you might say, of the modern university. No question about it. This was, as I said, a very exciting time to live through. And what I disliked about the after effects were there was a reaction to all the turmoil of the late 1960s, and things sort of leveled off and pretty dull.
That's interesting you used the adjective dull. Did you find the student body less interesting to teach in the 80s and 90s?
Good point. When I was teaching at Oberlin, I had just come out of graduate school, and I had to work hard just to stay abreast or a little bit farther ahead than my students, because the students at Oberlin were really quite bright. It's a highly selective, you know, college, and most of the students there were, as I said, very bright. They studied all the time. On weekends, the library was jam-packed, and I had to work very hard as a new assistant professor to stay ahead of my students. And when I came to Wisconsin, after 2 years at Oberlin in 1966, I had to work equally as hard to stay abreast with my students, because they were just as good, for the most part, at least the students I had, as those at Oberlin. One reason is that the university in the late 60s is a very cosmopolitan university. There were lots of students from New York City there, also known as Jews. Uh-huh. And because many of the TAs and many of the student political leaders were also from New York City and were also identified as Jews, they were, in a sense, labeled as student agitators. And I don't know how it occurred, but in the 1970s, the out-of-state enrollment, I think, dropped significantly. And many students from New York City, some of the better ones, put it this way, it seemed like the quality of the undergraduate student population declined during the 1970s. There's nothing I could quantify. It's just something that I felt in teaching my classes. Maybe students became more reticent. Maybe that's a better way to characterize them. Well, in the 60s, if I can generalize, I had a lively interaction with students. They were rather forceful and they wanted to express their ideas. I felt like in the 70s, and certainly later on, that students were more reticent in class. I can't really say, you know, if they were intellectually as good as the students I first encountered at Wisconsin. It's hard to quantify. But I was certainly impressed with the quality of the students when I came here.
And you continued to teach in the 80s and 90s. Did you see any other changes, Tim?
Well, I don't know. It's hard to separate certain things out because one has to, you know, figure out where you were. I'll put it this way: my perception of things was affected by some personal things in my life. I had been very successful as an academic and as an administrator, I think, and I felt like I had been shot out of a cannon when I graduated from Indiana University when I got my PhD. So that by the age of 37, I was a full professor. I had acquired the United Artists Collection, been the head of a major research center, and in a sense, you know, I had a major success as an academic. But then I felt like there was postpartum depression, for I had achieved everything that I had wanted. Uh-huh. At age 37. Then I had to really try to reinvent myself after that, and try to figure out ways to revive my enthusiasm for my work, my life, and it took a while to do. Uh-huh. I think one's career goes up and down, it fluctuates. It doesn't exist only on one plane by any means. And in order to remain productive as a scholar, you have to figure out ways, and as a teacher and as a person, I think everybody has to figure out ways to reinvent yourself after a while. Otherwise, you face tedium and boredom and death.
And it's true, actually.
Yeah. So,
Tino, before I leave the subject of students, any graduate students that you worked with that were particularly noteworthy, that you enjoyed working with, or who went on to do good work?
Yeah, so one of my first graduate students went on to become a major star in the field. His name was Douglas Gummery. He was an economics student here at the university as an undergraduate, and was looking for new horizons after he graduated from, after he received his baccalaureate degree here, and contacted the department, contacted me, and asked me if there's any chance of him coming over and studying film, despite the fact that he was an economics major. And I said, sure, come on over. We'd be more than glad to work with you. And I did. And he went on to write a very important dissertation, which analyzed the advent of sound in the history of motion pictures, and did an economic analysis of how corporations acquire and respond to new technology. After he got his dissertation, he published the book and published many, many articles on this subject, and became identified as more than my co-equal as a major historian on the economics of the motion picture industry. So that was very satisfying to see that as well.
Time period for when you were?
Oh, this was in the 70s.
Yeah,
right. I've had other students who have done very well for themselves, writing dissertations under me. I've learned a lot from my graduate students. I always feel that they are my collaborators, and I still feel this way today. Like, for example, as I am writing this book on the history of foreign films in the United States, I've taught graduate seminars on the subject on many occasions, and my graduate students have written research papers that I am using, and of course I will acknowledge, because I think of this as a group effort.
Are there any others that you want to mention by name, Tino?
Yes, there is Robert Gustafson, who wrote a dissertation on Warner Communications, which was a major entertainment, and still is, a major entertainment conglomerate. Bob went out and he left academe, unfortunately, but his dissertation was good enough that I asked him to write a chapter on that subject, which I included in my revised edition of the American film industry.
Oh.
Also, I had the good fortune to work with a graduate student by the name of Robert Anderson, who wrote a revisionist history of an important period of film industry history called the Motion Picture Patents Company. The Motion Picture Patents Company was actually controlled by Thomas Edison, and there was lots of myths surrounding this company and how it affected the growth of the early film industry. But he went to the primary sources and wrote a revisionist history on that subject as well. So, as a matter of fact, I had invited him also to write a chapter that I included in my revised version of the American film industry as well. Mm-hmm. In recent years, I must say, when I became chair of the Arts Consortium and then executive director of the Arts Institute, I did not have close ties to the graduate students in my department because of all of my administrative work.
Mm-hmm.
And I did work with some graduate students, but unfortunately, my administrative work took me out of the mainstream of graduate film studies. My colleagues had to pick up the slack.
But it does sound like that you have spawned a number of significant students who are still out there.
Yeah, I think so. Yes, absolutely. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Tino, I'd like to turn your attention now back to the issue of your service to the university,
right. Yes.
Which is quite distinguished and covers quite a number of areas. Two committees in particular that we're interested in having you comment on is the Provost Search and Screen Committee in 2001, and then you were involved in the search for the new chancellor.
Right. Well, the chancellor search came first.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the provost search. I should probably preface all this by saying that I was on all these important universities committees when I was executive director of the Arts Institute. And there was a rationale for this. It isn't just that I wanted to punish myself by being on all these committees, but I wanted to establish like what I would hope would be like a prototype for a person in my position representing the arts on campus. Some of these university committees, like the Humanities Divisional Committee, the Graduate School Executive Committee, and others, have ex officio memberships, which means that, for example, the Graduate School Executive Committee will always have a representative of the Humanities Divisional Committee, or one appointed by the Humanities Divisional Committee to represent the humanities on the Graduate School Executive Committee. Now, the university has divided up academia into four worlds, or into four subsets: biological sciences, physical sciences, social sciences, and the humanities. Well, where are the arts? Mm-hmm. Well, in any event, one of the offshoots of this was the fact that the Humanities Divisional Committee, after I left the committee and when I became executive director of the Arts Institute, renamed itself and called itself the Arts and Humanities Divisional Committee to identify the arts as being an important constituent of the university. Well, this type of thing is important. So I felt it was incumbent upon me as executive director to represent as best I could the arts on these important committees. Mm-hmm. And I spent a considerable amount of time sitting on these committees, being the voice of the arts, whatever, and the humanities as well, as best I could. And on more than one occasion, I was appointed to these committees by the then chair, or chairs of the Arts and Humanities Divisional Committee. So I just took it upon myself to take on the responsibility of trying to represent the arts within the university governance system. You know, I was talking earlier about my vision for the Arts Institute as being more than just a service organization,
yes,
plugged into the School of Education. I had hoped that it would be, would have a higher administrative, that it would have a higher administrative clout within the university, so that there would be opportunities for somebody representing the arts to the Arts Institute to be the so-called ex officio members of important university committees. But anyway, that didn't work out the way I had planned, but nonetheless I did spend a lot of time working in these committees, particularly the campus planning committee. I enjoyed that. That was a very important committee to be on. One could really see how the university functioned at a very high level, what its plans were as far as new construction was concerned, and and we had, of course, veto power over new construction, but of course we never exercised it. We always approved everything that came down the pike. But nonetheless, I really felt that in my last half a dozen years or so at the university, I really felt that I began to learn more about the university than I had even imagined during the previous 30 years as a professor here. Mm-hmm. So I never begrudged the time. I found it to be sometimes dull and boring about, but very exciting. And the long and short of it is, it was a very educational experience for me.
And I think to this day are very knowledgeable about the university and the campus.
I think so, probably as much as most professors at the event.
So Tino, talk now about your presence on the Chancellor Search Committee, and this is the committee that eventually hired John Wiley.
That is correct. Yes, the one had to apply to be chosen. Catherine Lyle, the president of the University of Wisconsin system, was actually the person in charge of creating this committee to search for David Ward's replacement. And I wrote a letter and explaining my interest in serving and describing my qualifications, and she appointed me to be a member of the committee. It was a very prestigious committee to be on, and it was handled very expertly by Bernice Durand, who was a professor of physics. She took her job seriously. She conducted the meetings on a very formal level, formal level that gave dignity to the entire proceedings. It wouldn't have been my style necessarily, but I appreciated what she did. And I was honored to be a part of this rather large committee representing a cross-section of university interests to choose a new chancellor.
And what was the process? Did you end up having to send a list of finalists to Lyle?
That was correct, to the Board of Regents. The process was spend a lot of time discussing the ground rules. How are we going to conduct our business? What procedures are we going to use? How to maintain confidentiality? How to be absolutely fair in the deliberative process? So that took many meetings to discuss all this, to understand the ground rules. Then the next step would be typically to approve, the job description, so to speak. And then you have to wait until the job announcement goes out, and then you begin to receive applications. Meanwhile, as a result of the recommendation from Catherine Lyle, we hired a headhunting firm to help us ferret out appropriate candidates. And this company was called Korn Ferry. It's a rather prominent headhunting firm in the country. I guess one of its strengths is to help universities find appropriate executives to fill leadership roles. And then, you go through the tedious task of reading all the letters of application. And you sift and winnow. And after you read all these applications, you go around and discuss the strengths and weaknesses, and you reduce a large number of applications to a smaller number of people you want to consider in more detail. And then if you need to get additional information on these people, you do that. So you're constantly reducing the pool of applicants to a core group.
Tino, I think lots of people are interested in the sense of, is it truly a process that looks as seriously at outside candidates as inside candidates?
That's a good question. Now, it's quite clear that John Wiley was a contender from day one, and everybody knew him. I mean, you couldn't deny a person's existence. And now, this is a double-edged sword, you must understand, because he had been here, he'd been a very proactive provost, a very articulate administrator. Everybody knew him. But at the same time, people could learn to hate him as well. I mean, and in the case, that's overstated, but by virtue of being on campus as a known quantity, you can't mythologize these people because you know their strengths and weaknesses because you work with them. Whereas some people from the outside, you may try to characterize in a positive way, which ignores their potential weaknesses. It just has a psychological process of how you go about evaluating known people and unknown candidates. And as I said, that being known is a double-edged sword. There were people in high-level administrative positions at the UW who applied for the job, who were dismissed as serious candidates because they were known as having certain characteristics. I can recall one time, the process was that when we advanced a person to the next level, we would go around the room and after full deliberation of a person's qualifications, and then the chair would ask each person, yay or nay, shall we move this person up? Or the chair, or perhaps the chair would say, if you wish to move this person up to the next category, raise your hand. And there was the case of one person who was being considered. And if a person received one vote, that person would be moved up to the next level for further consideration. And there was a person from the university we were considering, and the chair posed the question, yay or nay. And I stared down at my hands. I didn't look around. I think other people were staring down at their hands as well. And then this person got not one single vote. And I said, wow, to myself. Because nothing was said against this person to any great extent during the discussion. But obviously people had formed opinions. Mm-hmm. And they were strong enough to prevent this person from being moved up for further consideration. So there were some surprises like that. We tried hard to find appropriate people from the outside, but you must understand, Wisconsin is a high-powered university. And applicants from other state universities just don't often measure up in terms of prestige and accomplishments and so forth and so on. So we did not, if I remember correctly, receive that many applicants from peer institutions.
Oh.
This is tape number 7, side 1, Emeritus Professor Tino Baglio, December 1st, 2005.
I mentioned that we did not receive many applications from candidates from peer institutions. And the question is, why not? Well, the major reason is that the University of Wisconsin pays very poorly. As a matter of fact, the chancellor's salary was pathetic compared to what chancellors and presidents were being paid at peer institutions. And today, of course, the gap is even wider. You read in the papers that college presidents get paid $1 million a year. And I suppose this was an inhibiting factor. If you were a talented administrator who could be taken seriously to lead a major university like Wisconsin, you certainly wouldn't want to take a pay cut to come here. Mm-hmm. And obviously this was a factor. Now, at the same time, as you probably know, the UW Foundation devised a way to increase the compensation for the chancellor, which I think is set by the state. The chancellor can't, by state rules, cannot be paid more than the governor or some such thing. So the foundation devised a way to provide the new chancellor, John Wiley, with an employment contract to supplement his salary. That sweetened the deal, but I don't know if that was in place at the time that we did the search. I don't think so. So this limited the pool of potential applicants for the job. Well, the long and short of it is that somebody would have, in my opinion, somebody would have to beat out John Wiley. And there was nobody that we considered, in my opinion, who could have come close.
And was that clear to you from almost the beginning?
Well, yes, absolutely. Absolutely, because, well, I suppose I was that I was thinking along traditional lines, that at this university, administrators go up through the ranks and ultimately seek whatever level they can achieve. And up until, with that one exception that I mentioned, down the Shalala, the university had not gone outside to find a leader, at least at the chancellor's level. So I suppose I was being somewhat conditioned by university tradition. But at the same time, I would have been prepared to seriously consider a contender who I thought was as good, if not better, than John Wiley. And I would like to think that other people in the committee would have felt the same way. But the other contenders, and we interviewed these people personally, by the way, we interviewed some fine people. Don't misunderstand me. We felt that these were substantial people, people of integrity and the like, but they just were not at John Wiley's level in terms of having a command of the subject, if you will, the sharpness of his or her mind and everything. So it was a no-brainer, you might say, on our part. And we recommended unanimously John Wiley. To be quite honest with you, I don't know if we submitted a short list or not. I think we may have had to submit the list, and then Catherine Lyle and the Region Search Committee attended a meeting, and we all went around the table and discussed what we thought were the strengths and weaknesses of each individual candidate. Mm-hmm. And then as a result of this, they made the selection list. But, you know, they have to. They are the appointing authority, and they made the decision.
Mm-hmm. How long did the process take?
A whole semester, maybe even longer than that. I don't remember the length, but it was a long, drawn-out process.
Ask you to step out just a bit, but as you think about the future of the university, are you concerned over the issue of salary and the ability to attract first-rate chancellors in the future?
Well, I think it's going to be a crucial issue. Higher education is becoming more competitive these days. The University of Wisconsin, you know, it's always been a mystery to me, that it's a first-rate university, better than the state deserves. And yet, despite the fact that the state is cutting back on funding for the university, this is nothing new. In fact, it would be the exception to the rule when the state increased its funding to the university, at least as far as my memory of the university is concerned. The downward pull exercised by the state legislature has been incessant, or endemic, if you will, over the years. And the question is, how has the university been able to maintain its level of quality and prestige despite this fact? But I don't have the answer to it. Mm-hmm.
It is a paradox, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. I never thought about leaving the university. I could have put myself on the market, but it never occurred to me to want to leave. It isn't that I was always enjoying myself here either. I mean, but the thought of leaving never occurred to me.
And I find that has been typical of many of these mm-hmm. interviews.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that the issue of faculty governance, even though for many years I was not really a part of it, always made me feel like, well, this is a faculty-run and controlled university. And administrators come and go, and sometimes you have to just endure some of them. But it wasn't a top-down university, and I guess that was a factor that made me feel discomfortable being here.
Mm-hmm. Tino, let me now ask you to comment on the Provost Search Committee,
yeah.
Which was 2001.
Right. I was appointed by the Arts and Humanities Divisional Committee to serve on that as well. That wasn't as challenging it was a different type of experience, put it this way. The searching for a provost is quite different from searching for a chancellor, primarily because at some universities, the position of provost is a very important, powerful position. But at the University of Wisconsin, the provost position is not quite as strong.
Oh, really?
No. The reason for this is that the deans pretty much control their own budgets. As I was discussing earlier, the institutional history of the University of Wisconsin is in its budgets.
Yes.
And because we don't have excess funding to reallocate or to move around, budgets remain pretty much the same year in and year out. And the university has a teaching and research mission. So a provost cannot diddle with this rigid structure to keep the operations going. So it's really the deans who are capable of making major decisions pertaining to the day-to-day life of the university. The provost obviously has lots of important things to do, administrative things to do, that are mandated by the university system. But in terms of actually exercising power or influence, in my opinion, the provost doesn't have much.
Huh.
It may be more of a training ground or to become the chancellor, or stepping stone, you might say, to become chancellor. But in itself, the provost doesn't have, cannot be compared to the authority of the chancellor in terms of the influence that the chancellor has and so forth. Because the provost doesn't really represent the university except in ex officio ways to the, so forth. He has to sign off. When a tenure case goes up through the system, that he has to sign off on it. But it would be, unimaginable for the provost to disagree with the decision, the tenure decision approved by a dean.
Technically
he could. And it happens at Whitewater, it happens throughout the university system, but it doesn't happen at UW-Madison.
Uh-huh.
I don't mean to say that the provost position is a menial position by any means. I mean, the provost has to do a lot. I'm sure he does a lot in terms of his working with important faculty, on campus to keep them happy and everything. But in terms of being able to use a budget or budgets or funds to do things, no, I don't think so.
When you sat on that committee, were there clear indications from John Wiley as to who he wanted as his provost?
No. The John Wiley talked to us as a committee, if I remember correctly, as to telling us what kind of person he was looking for, or what kind of person. But we asked him what he had done as provost, and so forth. It's a bit hazy, to be quite honest, because to this day I can't really specify the day-to-day duties of the provost. I know that the provost chairs certain committees, like the provost chairs the University Academic Planning Committee, but this committee reviews programs, and it has a high-powered sound to the name of the committee, but again, because of faculty governance, by the time these new program initiatives come to the University Academic Planning Committee, they have been thoroughly vetted by other people beforehand. And this is just the final step to receive formal approval for new programs. Like, for example, when the Arts Institute was formed, it had to get approval by the University Academic Planning Committee. So we sent up all the documentation with the recommendations, and the University Academic Planning Committee examined the materials and of course approved the creation of the Arts Institute. But this is the way things are done.
Uh-huh.
It isn't that there's somebody up in Baskin Hill that you can just sort of rubber stamp anything. It has to go through an academic vetting process. So it's hard to know precisely what the provost does. the provost, when I was in the Dean's Council, before it was restructured, when John Miley became chancellor, the provost chaired the Dean's Council meetings. And the chancellor was just in attendance, and David Ward just spoke up whenever he wanted to, but it was John Miley as provost who chaired the Dean's Council meetings. And that's how I got to know him. I mean, I shouldn't state it that way. That's how I was able to observe him. I can't say that I got to know John Wiley very well. That's how I got to observe him at work. He had a command. His knowledge of the university was immense, and his ability to recall specific details was impressive. Okay. I would not want to argue with him.
So yeah. You do make it sound like serving on the selection committee for the provost was of far less interest to you than serving on the chancellor's.
Well, the stakes were less, put it this way. I was interested, but the quality of the status of the people who were applying for the job was clearly different from the people we were evaluating for the chancellor's position.
And this process resulted in bringing back Peter Speer.
That's correct.
From Colorado.
That's correct.
Was it difficult for you with the fact that one of your colleagues, Marianne Fitzpatrick, applied for that position?
No, it wasn't difficult. I had worked with Marianne. I should state that I was the associate chair of the Communication Arts Department while she was chair of the department. And she was chair for only a year or two, and then she became an associate dean. Then I moved in as chair, so I had an opportunity to work with her and observe her. And she was certainly on an upward trajectory at this time. And this is as a footnote here, she was very instrumental in ensuring that our department would have a major stake in this whole restructuring of the undergraduate curriculum. I'm referring specifically to the communications requirements that were introduced. Prior to this time, the English composition would have been the single course that all undergraduates would have taken to meet a writing requirement. But clearly the English department would not be large enough to take on this burden, but she ensured that our undergraduate course, public speaking, would be one of two options that students could take to fulfill their writing or communications requirement. And she worked diligently to make this happen. And this, of course, this had a tremendous impact on our department, because this meant that we could hire TAs. Few humanities departments have TAs, because they don't teach courses requiring teaching assistantships. But Communication Arts has around 50 such TA positions, primarily as a result of this undergraduate requirement. And this, of course, has an impact on the graduate population that the department has. So I was aware of Marianne Fitzpatrick's strengths. I felt that there were some weaknesses or drawbacks to her at this point in her career. I don't think she was seasoned enough to deal with to conflict appropriately. But I think we gave her, I felt like gave her a fair evaluation. Mm-hmm. But as it happened, it isn't so much a matter of voting down a person, it's just a matter of other people rising higher in one's estimation. It isn't as if we said, no, Marianne, we're not going to consider her, because we did consider her, and I think she was on a short list that we gave the chancellor. So we did not sidetrack her by any means.
Tino, do you have any observations about thinking, since you were involved with the selection of John Wiley and Peter Speer, the current controversy swirling around Bascom involving Paul Barrows.
Yeah.
Any observations about how that was handled or your expectations of how Wiley and Speer might have handled this? And how much damage, if any, it's really going to do to the university?
Well, to answer your second question, your last question first, I think it did some damage. I don't know how lasting it's going to be, but it gave another opportunity to this state legislature to slam the university. It seems like we have a very volatile conservative state legislature, and this treatment of Barrows enabled some of the more retrograde members of the state legislature to bash the university. Mm-hmm. This happens all the time. Over time, this happens frequently. But I don't know how long this is going to last. I don't think the university is going to change its procedures here by having backup positions, for example, because deans serve at the pleasure of the chancellor. And if a dean, for one reason or another, does not perform appropriately, the chancellor should have the right to say, step down as dean and return to your tenure home to teach, whatever, and then I'll appoint somebody else. You can't tether a chancellor to when the chancellor's job is to make the university run efficiently. And if a chancellor can't replace a dean easily, even though this infrequently happens, it would tie the hands of the chancellor to effectively run the university. I think I understood John Wiley's initial response to Paul Barrows. He probably wanted to save a man's career. And how it was handled, I mean, did he want to see Paul Barrows go down in flames? I think he just wanted to save his career somehow or another, but it got out of hand. Once it hit the, you know, the press, John Wiley's lost control of the case.
It seems to have disappeared for the moment.
Yeah.
Tino, maybe this is a good point to ask you to reflect on significant chancellors and deans that you have worked with, both in the College of Letters and Science and up on Bascom, because your career here spans going back to 1966. You've served under any number of deans and chancellors.
Yes, I must say though that I had practically no contact with any chancellor until I was appointed by David Ward to be the chair of the Arts Consortium. So I did have some interaction, of course, with Ed Young when I was the director of the center. I always thought he was a warm, personable guy who was supportive, but he did not have any direct control or oversight of anything that I did. Working with David Ward, I tried to exercise, he gave me an opportunity to figure out what I could do for the arts on his behalf. I was sorry to see him leave because, in a way, I was a creature of his initiative. Mm-hmm. When John Wiley became chancellor, I didn't feel that I had a particularly close rapport with him. And I should say for the record here, I was somewhat disappointed, if not disgruntled, with the way in which John Wiley announced his plans to create an arts district on campus. When I was chair of the Arts Consortium, I organized a course for arts students that was called Making Things Work. That was the official title. But then the subtitle of the course was Planning a Campus Arts District. And John Wiley, participated in this. This is a one-credit course that we met weekly. We brought in guest speakers to to talk about the concept of a campus arts district. What is an arts district? What does it do? How do you create one? Things like this. And my argument was that, in essence, we had already on our campus an arts district, but it was not labeled as such or identified as such. Because if you look at the lower end of the campus and begin at the level of Lake Mendota and work your way south, you have the Wisconsin Union Theater, you have the performance venues in Humanities Hall, you have the theaters in Vilas Hall, you have the Elvium. And in a sense, you know, if you looked at all these facilities and the academic departments around them, this would constitute in essence what I said, that we really had an arts district on campus, but it was not identified or labeled as such. But in any event, I think I introduced the whole idea of a campus arts district, and this, of course, was an outgrowth of my job as chair of the Arts Consortium and executive director of the Arts Institute. I must say that as a result of this class, a design class in the Department of Art was taught by John Meaden, a group of his students took up this idea. And as a class project, they designed a whole signage and communication system that could have been implemented to create an arts district on campus. You know, this was an academic exercise. And as a matter of fact, this was such a great idea that we did two things. First of all, we had an exhibit of the renderings and designs of these students in a little gallery on University Avenue, to which George Austin was invited. This was when the Overture Center was being contemplated and designed. And also, this was when John Wiley was provost and chair of the Campus Planning Committee. We arranged for these students to make a presentation to the Campus Planning Committee to introduce this idea. Well, anyway, when John Wiley became chancellor, he had great plans to support the arts, particularly music and art, and the Elvian Museum. And as a matter of fact, he even invited Cesar Pelli to tour that end of the campus to get Cesar Pelli's ideas as to how to construct an arts district. But I was never involved in any of these deliberations. And I had to read about these things in the newspaper. And I was disappointed in this. And this was a further evidence that my position within the university hierarchy, you know, was somewhat diminished. I just thought this was a poor way to. He's a very busy guy, anyway. But you read these things and respond accordingly.
And you had been instrumental in the.
Well, at least I introduced the idea formally to the university camp. It isn't that the idea of an arts district, you know, I was not the first person to think of it by any means. But because the Overture Center was being, Jerry Frauschi had announced his plans to create the Overture Center downtown. And at the time, when he announced his plans to construct this building, there was some thought of the city developing an arts district downtown. So I said to myself, well, how is this going to impact the university?
Right.
And so that led me to examine this whole subject. As a matter of fact, also when I was director of the Arts Institute, I organized another course that was called the Overture Center, the Art and Design of a Cultural Arts Center. And I did this in collaboration with the Overture Foundation, which arranged for all of the design consultants, and Susan, including Cesar Pelle's office, to talk to the students and to describe their contributions to the overall design of the Overture Center.
Right.
And this was a unique opportunity for students, there were about 60 students in this class, to observe this whole process of designing a major world-class cultural arts center. Mm-hmm. So when John Wiley just either ignored me or whatever, I don't know if this was a conscious decision on this part or not, but nonetheless, it had an effect on, sort of soured my relationship to things.
Yes. Tino, did you have much to do with Donna Shalala?
No. I met her, but no, she was a tough cookie. I knew that she was interested in films, and I was, I think, the interim or acting director of the center at the time. I offered to make some films available to her if she wanted to, but she wasn't here that long, and she was, I did not have a chance to interact with her. I was in the faculty senate for a while, and of course, she chaired the faculty senate at that time, and she was chancellor, of course, but no, I never had a chance to interact with her.
Did you think her presence on campus was a net gain or loss?
Yeah, it was. The university had to be shaken up somewhat. I'm not certain that I could agree with everything she did, because it's hard to know what the cause and what the effects are of leadership, but she certainly shook up the troops. And I know that the women faculty on campus enjoyed her presence enormously. And I think that as I said earlier, she opened up some windows that needed to be opened up. And I think that her presence here was a transition,
uh-huh.
Created a transition from the old university to a newer and different one. I'm not saying this is better, but one that's more in tune with contemporary thinking.
Tino, let's switch now to the deans of letters and science.
Right. When money was flowing, there was never any problems with deans. I mean, when I first came here, the deans I worked under pretty much rubber-stamped everything that I needed. Basically, when I started out as director of the center, my contact person in LMS was Robert Doremus, who was the associate dean. Now LMS has four associate deans, but back then they only had one. And Bob Doremus was in charge of almost everything, and he was the one who approved the annual budgets for the center. Now then, David Cronin became dean, and he had a more hands-on feeling towards things. And this, I can't fault David Cronin for not supporting the center any more than he did. And he did not support the center. He maintained the status quo, but as I pointed out earlier, maintaining the status quo in essence was creating economic hardship because of the erosion of your budget. But I guess in retrospect, the thing that I disliked about him enormously was the fact that he did not talk to the faculty or explain to them adequately what the economic plight was of LMS to make the faculty understand, at least me understand, you know, this is a shared burden that we all have to experience, and that he was not out for me or the center or whatever. His way of communicating was not very pleasant. And clearly, I'm not so naive as to think that I at any point should receive special treatment, but I think one of the things deans can do or administrators can do is to explain in a compassionate way the status of the institution that they are administering.
Okay.
That's the bottom line in my opinion. And it's difficult for deans to articulate what their goals are. And maybe they do to some people, but I didn't feel this was the case with David Cronin.
This is Side 2, Tape 7, December 1st, 2005, Emeritus Professor Tino Baglio.
Well, one final thing about being the head of a hybrid organization like the Center or the Arts Institute. In essence, you know, it took many years to understand this, that you can't expect to get more financial support from the institution, because there's only a finite amount of money to go around. And as a hybrid organization without a teaching mission, you're always going to be shortchanged. Or not shortchanged, you're always going to have to take second place to the primary mission of the university, which is teaching. You know, But what it allows you to do, though, by being the head of a hybrid organization, is allows you to go out and search for outside funding, because you know. But in the arts and humanities, it's practically impossible to raise outside funding. Now, if I were the head of a center or an institute in the sciences, perhaps there'd be more opportunities to compete. But it's extremely difficult to get this kind of outside funding on a regular basis to enable you to do new things. Also, you know, at this university, you have no full-time administrators except maybe the chancellor or a dean. But as a faculty member, you have allegiances to your department. You have research to do, and you teach in addition to your administration. So you can't really. I mean, there's only so much time in the day. So much energy that a person had to do all these things. And, like, for example, throughout my career, if I had not done as much research as I had done, I would not get the merit increases that I received, even though they were small because the university had very little to allocate. Because my department was evaluating me as a researcher. Mm-hmm. It was not the dean of LMS evaluating me as a director of the center. My department evaluating me as a teacher and a researcher in the department. So you could be a hotshot administrator in this university and not receive any significant merit increase because you're always evaluated by your home department at how well you do in your research and teaching. And your department does not influence that portion of your salary that constitutes in the outside administration. Mm-hmm. So I always felt that I was very entrepreneurial in my life here at the university, but I didn't receive much in the way of financial rewards as a result of this. My salary only began to go up when I became chair of the Arts Consortium because I got summer salary stipends, you know, which counted as, which buttressed my salary somewhat. But anyway, the University of Wisconsin is still a mystery.
Tino, maybe this is a good point to do our open mic session, as it were, with your observations about the university. What was good? What was the future that you see for it? What are issues coming down the pipe?
Well, I one of the things that I appreciate about my career was the fact that the university allowed me to exercise some of my entrepreneurial skills and interests. I don't think I would have been totally content just being a teacher scholar. Mm-hmm. I thought that it would have been just too confining. And the experiences I had as a result of being here, I mean, really quite, in retrospect, and speaking collectively of all of them, really quite exciting. Because when I was first the head of the center, I traveled a lot. I was able to meet a lot of people, important people in the arts, significant people in the arts and humanities, and which I would never have had just by being a regular teacher. And my work and the Arts Institute, you know, enabled me to see new facets of higher education and have interactions with people nationally that I wouldn't have had. I really appreciated these opportunities in retrospect, but at the time, even though I put in a great deal of work, and many times my job was extremely frustrating, you know, trying to be a leader of the arts without having any fiscal controls is quite a chore, believe me. And you have to have a lot of chutzpah. You have to believe in yourself a lot. And I don't have a lot of chutzpah. And I had to sort of inflate myself up to a certain size in order to deal with this job I was given to be, quote, the arts czar, which is really a misnomer. I was no more of a czar than anything else. You know, coming from my roots from Hammond, Indiana, from my background that I had, growing up and my family and everything, I had no regrets. Uh-huh.
And you said earlier, Tino, that you never entertained the thought of leaving the university.
Right.
Which is interesting to me because you were so accomplished that you could have gone other places.
It never occurred to me, to be quite honest. I saw colleagues get outside job offers, and as a result, boost their salaries, but I wouldn't do that. I mean, I'd only do it if I was truly interested in leaving. Yeah. But Wisconsin's a beautiful state. The liberal traditions of the university and the state were a major attraction. It's a clean state, it's a beautiful state, and the university, you know, did not breathe down your back, gave you freedom, and the teaching assignments were not that onerous. I mean, it was worse elsewhere, believe me.
Tino, let me ask you a question that I have wanted to ask you for years, and now we can do this. If you would record for posterity's sake what some of your personal favorite movies are.
Oh, yes. One that my wife and I refer to many times, especially in moments of crises, is The Godfather. I have watched Godfather Part 1 more often than Part 2. I don't like Part 3, but Part 1 in particular I like very much. I never grow tired of watching that movie. Maybe it's because of this fantasy of believing that one person or a family or a group of people could have the total control and total power over everything. You know, where there is justice, with Undertaker, you know, goes to the Godfather and says, "I want justice, Godfather." And that's, of course, that's the cry that all of us have. I want justice. And you seldom ever get it in life. But this movie always is a very satisfying one. And the Godfather will provide justice and retribution and everything. So that has always been a fun movie to watch and rewatch. Other than that, I must say, I have many tastes, manifold tastes, and I go to all different kinds of movies to satisfy different interests at whatever time. It could be 30s movies, which I thoroughly enjoyed, particularly the films of Betty Davis, because she's such a fine actress. And then, of course, now that I'm working on foreign films, some of the films that I refer to again and again, depending upon one's mood, I enjoy. I like the Bicycle Thief and others. I really can't say that I have one or two favorite films. I use films the way some people play an instrument. Depending upon my mood and interest at the time. I have a lot of access to films. I own a lot, and of course, so I have an array of choices to choose from.
This concludes the oral history interview with Emeritus Professor Tino Baglio. Tino, it has been a pleasure.
Thank you.